Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. After today's presentation, there will be a question-and-answer session. At that time, to ask your questions, you press star then one on your phone. Today's conference call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. I would now like to introduce your host. We have Ms. Loretta Jackson, and ma'am, you may begin.
Thank you, Lori. Good afternoon. I'm Loretta Jackson Brown, and I am representing the Clinician Outreach and Communication Activity, COCA, with the Emergency Communication System at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. I am delighted to welcome you to today's COCA conference call, Promoting Health and Preventing Disease, Childhood and Adult Vaccine Updates and Recommendations. We are pleased to have with us today Dr. Yabo Baisolo, Medical Officer, National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, to discuss how clinicians can foster the promotion of childhood and adult immunizations in clinical practice. During today's call, you will hear the presenter referring to slides in her PowerPoint presentation. The PowerPoint slide set is available from our COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. Click on conference calls. The slide set can be found under the call in number and call passcode. The objectives for today's call are that participants will be able to discuss two recent vaccine recommendations made by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, identify the types and location of immunization resources and steps for accessing resources, describe two vaccine administration issues. Following the presentation, you will have an opportunity to ask our presenter questions. Dialing star 1 will put you into the queue for questions. In compliance with continuing education requirements, all presenters must disclose any financial or other relationship with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial supporters, as well as any use of an unlabeled product or products under investigational use. This presentation will not include the discussion of the unlabeled use of a product or product under investigational use, with the exception of certain vaccine use that is recommended by the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, but not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. The names of the vaccines can be found on slide 4 of the presentation slide set located on the COCA webpage. CDC, our planners, and our presenter wish to disclose that they have no financial interest or other relationships with the manufacturers of commercial products, suppliers of commercial services, or commercial support. There is no commercial support for this presentation. Today's presenter, Dr. Yabo Baisolo, graduated from the University of Medicine and Dentistry of New Jersey, Robert Wood Johnson Medical School, with a joint MD-MPH concentration in family health. She completed her pediatric residency at Emory University in Atlanta. She is board certified in pediatrics. Dr. Baisolo has worked as a practicing pediatrician in various clinical settings to include the Whiteford Elementary School Health Clinic, a large private pediatric practice, her own pediatric practice, Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, and Emory University School of Medicine. Since June 2008, Dr. Baisolo has worked as a medical officer in the Education, Information, and Partnership branch of the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Diseases at the CDC. Her responsibilities include the development and implementation of immunization education and training materials for vaccine providers, lectures on vaccine-preventable diseases, and presentations at courses as well as web and net conferences. If you're following along on the slides, you should be on slide 6. Again, the PowerPoint slide set is available from our COCA website at emergency.cdc.gov/COCA. At this time, please welcome today's presenter, Dr. Baisolo.
Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to be able to provide you with recent updates to childhood and adult vaccine recommendations from the CDC. As providers continue to see an increasing number of patients on a daily basis, challenges remain, such as ensuring that providers are keeping up with all the new recommendations in the vaccine world, the need to train staff on immunizations, and also explain the benefit of vaccines to patients. Once a vaccine is licensed by the FDA, the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, or ACIP, meets and votes on recommendations for use of the vaccine. ACIP then advises CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services on the vaccine's use in the U.S. population. Today, we'll discuss some of the updated recommendations made within the last year, as well as recommendations for newer vaccines. We'll also spend some time on how and where one can access vaccine resources quickly, including the published ACIP recommendations, clinical tools such as immunization schedules, as well as tips for increasing vaccine coverage rates. We'll now move on to slide 8. We'll begin by briefly looking at the 2010 immunization schedule and changes you may or may not have been aware of, and then we'll move on to more specific vaccines in the pediatric and adult world. At the end of the session, as Mrs. Brown mentioned, we'll have a few minutes for a question and answer segment. Now on to slide 9. Here is a copy of the 2010 childhood immunization schedule. Immunization schedules are an integral part of immunization practice. Because immunization recommendations change frequently, the schedules for the United States have been revised at least annually since 1995. The schedule for children and adolescents through 18 years of age and for adults 19 years and older are issued separately. The immunization schedules represent a concise summary of existing recommendations. There are two additional childhood schedules, one for 17 through 18-year-olds, as well as a catch-up schedule. For the childhood schedule, updates this year have included the use of meningococcal conjugate revaccination, an updated statement regarding the use of combination vaccines, updated intervals for the dosing of polio vaccine, as well as when the last dose of polio vaccine is recommended in childhood, and the use of human papillomavirus vaccine in females and males. Please remember, though, to always refer to the footnotes in all of the immunization schedules as you view them. Next slide. The adult schedule did not have as many changes, but again, the reminder there is to please read the footnotes as you utilize the schedule. We'll begin our vaccine discussion with the new pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, or PCV13. You should now be on slide 13. PCV13 was licensed for use by the FDA in February of 2010. PCV13 and PCV7 are manufactured in a similar fashion, and PCV13 will replace PCV7 for prevention of pneumococcal disease in children. Streptococcus pneumoniae can present as bacteremia, meningitis, pneumonia, or otitis media in children. Bacteremia without a known site of infection is the most common invasive clinical presentation of pneumococcal infection among children 2 years and younger. With the decline of invasive hip disease, strep pneumo has become the leading cause of bacterial meningitis among children under 5 years old in the U.S. And, of course, pneumococci are also a common cause of acute otitis media in children. Middle ear infections are the most frequent reason for pediatric office visits in the U.S., resulting in more than 20 million visits per year. Since the introduction of PCV7 vaccine in the year 2000, there is now significantly less pneumococcal disease caused by the 7 strains contained in that vaccine. Even though there is less disease overall, other strains of Streptococcus pneumoniae that are not in PCV7 have become more common. PCV13 includes 6 additional serotypes, protecting against more disease than PCV7. In particular, PCV13 vaccine protects against serotype 19A, which has become the most common pneumococcal serotype and is often resistant to antibiotics. PCV13, as you can see on the slide, was approved by the FDA for use among children 6 weeks through 71 months of age. Next slide. Like PCV7, ACIP recommends that PCV13 be given to all infants at 2, 4, and 6 months of age, followed by a booster dose for 12 through 15 month olds. As with PCV7 in the past, children who start the series late will require fewer total doses. Infants and children not immunized or incompletely immunized with PCV7 should begin or complete the schedule with PCV13. Slide 15 shows you an example of one of the very many helpful tables in the MMWR article that addresses ACIP recommendations for the use of PCV13. This table illustrates the routine dosing of PCV13 and number of doses needed depending on when the series was started. The table also shows you on the right the use of a booster dose at 12 to 15 months of age for children who begin the series under a year old. Please remember that this only pertains to children who are completing the series with only PCV13 doses. There are several other tables we show you how you can complete the series with PCV13 if PCV7 was used to start the series. These tables are available within the MMWR article cited. ACIP made additional recommendations for what is called a supplemental dose. Because of the extra serotypes in PCV13 versus PCV7, we want to make sure that all children have the benefit of receiving that extra protection. Hence, healthy children 14 through 59 months old who are fully vaccinated with PCV7 should receive one dose of PCV13 as a supplemental dose. ACIP nor AAP did not recommend routine vaccination with PCV13 for healthy children 5 years of age or older. However, ACIP recognized that there are some older children with certain medical conditions that put them at an increased risk of invasive pneumococcal disease. And so ACIP extended this age for the supplemental dose to 71 months in these children. Some of the children in this higher risk group may have already received PPSV23, the pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine. However, they are still recommended to also receive the PCV13 supplemental dose. Slide 17, this is a table from the MMWR listing the medical conditions and indications that would place a child in a higher risk group for pneumococcal disease or its complications. Children who fall into one of these groups are recommended to receive a supplemental dose of PCV13 through age 71 months. This includes immunocompetent children with chronic lung or heart disease, diabetes, or cochlear implants, children with functional or anatomic asplenia, including children with sickle cell disease, immunocompromised people, including children with HIV, chronic renal failure, diseases associated with immunosuppressive chemotherapy or radiation therapy, including leukemia, lymphoma, and other malignant neoplasms, and congenital immunodeficiency. Lastly, ACIP made an off-label recommendation to allow use of PCV13 in certain children over the age of 6. Remember that FDA licensed the vaccine for use in children 6 weeks through 71 months old. ACIP felt that there were older children at even higher risk for invasive pneumococcal disease because of certain underlying conditions. These include children with anatomic or functional asplenia, those with HIV infection and other immunocompromising conditions, those with cochlear implants, or have a CSF leak. Next, on slide 19, we'll move on to a discussion of meningococcal conjugate vaccines. Meningococcal disease is an acute, potentially severe illness caused by Neisseria meningitidis. It is the leading cause of bacterial meningitis and sepsis in the United States. The case fatality rate of invasive meningococcal disease is 9 to 12%, even with appropriate antibiotic therapy. The fatality rate of meningococcemia is up to 40%. As many as 20% of survivors have permanent sequelae, such as hearing loss, neurologic damage, or loss of a limb. Next slide. Meningococcal conjugate vaccine is routinely recommended for all persons ages 11 through 18 years old and if not previously vaccinated, all college freshmen living in a dormitory. The vaccine is also recommended for anyone 2 through 55 years of age at increased risk for meningococcal disease, including, shown on the next slide, those with functional or anatomic asplenia, frequent travelers to and U.S. citizens residing in countries in which Neisseria meningitis is hyperendemic or epidemic, those with persistent complement component deficiency, microbiologists routinely exposed to isolates of Neisseria meningitis, military recruits, and children with HIV infection. Back in 2005, when ACIP made recommendations for the use of meningococcal conjugate vaccine, which was Menactra, the only vaccine available at that time, data was lacking on whether revaccination would be needed. Serologic data are now available that show significant decline in antibody levels 3 to 5 years after vaccination, although few breakthrough cases have been reported. That is, there have been very few cases of invasive meningococcal disease in persons who previously received meningococcal conjugate vaccine. This signified that not everyone would need revaccination. Because of the higher risk for meningococcal disease among certain groups and limited data on duration of protection, at its June 2009 meeting, ACIP recommended that persons previously vaccinated with either meningococcal conjugate vaccine or meningococcal polysaccharide vaccine, MenImmune, who are at prolonged increased risk for meningococcal disease should be revaccinated with meningococcal conjugate vaccine. You should now be on slide 23, and this shows a graph. Persons with prolonged increased risk for meningococcal disease have increased susceptibility to the disease or ongoing increased risk for exposure to Neisseria meningitis, and higher levels of serum bactericidal antibody against Neisseria meningitis, or SBA, can provide these groups increased protection against disease. SBA is a measure of the ability of sera to kill a strain of Neisseria meningitis in the presence of complement. A SBA titer of 1 to 128 was used as a conservative correlate of protection. A small number of participants from the original Menactra pre-licensure clinical trial were revaccinated 3 years or 5 years after first receiving Menactra. Of those who had been vaccinated with meningococcal conjugate vaccine, the Menactra, 3 years previously, sera was collected before revaccination, and only 75% and 86% had SBA titers greater than 1 to 128 for serogroups C and Y respectively, that is, before being revaccinated. Of those who had been vaccinated with meningococcal conjugate vaccine 5 years previously, again, sera collected before revaccination showed that only 55% and 94% had SBA titers greater than 1 to 128 for serogroups C and Y respectively. In both studies, upon revaccination with meningococcal conjugate vaccine, subjects achieved SBA titers greater than 1 to 128 for serogroups C and Y. On the basis of these data, ACIP approved the proposal for revaccination in certain high-risk groups. Next slide. Based on the recommendations, the interval between vaccination and revaccination would depend on the age when the initial dose was given. So for children who receive their first dose at age 2 through 6 years and remain at increased risk for meningococcal disease, they should receive an additional dose 3 years after their first dose, and then every 5 years indefinitely if they remain in a high-risk group. Next slide, for those persons who receive their first dose at age 7 or older and remain at increased risk for meningococcal disease because of a high-risk condition or situation, then they should receive an additional dose 5 years after their initial dose. If that person remains in a high-risk group, they would need revaccination every 5 years thereafter with meningococcal conjugate vaccine. Once the age of 56 years is reached, meningococcal polysaccharide vaccine should be used, as meningococcal conjugate vaccines are only licensed through age 55 years old. Now you should be on slide 26. So who are the high-risk persons who should be revaccinated with meningococcal conjugate vaccine? Those with persistent complement component deficiency, anatomic or functional asplenia, microbiologists with prolonged exposure to Neisseria meningitidis, frequent travelers to or persons living in areas with high rates of meningococcal disease. Next slide. Although the duration of protection from meningococcal conjugate vaccine is not known, most entering college students will have received meningococcal conjugate vaccine within the preceding 4 years. Because of the limited period of increased risk, ACIP currently does not recommend that college freshmen living in dormitories who were previously vaccinated with meningococcal conjugate vaccine be revaccinated. Said another way, healthy children who received a routine dose of meningococcal conjugate vaccine do not need to be revaccinated if their only risk for meningococcal disease is living in a college dormitory. The ACIP Meningococcal Working Group continues to discuss this issue. Of note is that college freshmen living in dormitories who were vaccinated with meningococcal polysaccharide vaccine more than 5 years previous are recommended to be revaccinated with meningococcal conjugate vaccine. Lastly on this subject, slide 28, we now have two meningococcal conjugate vaccines available for use. Menveo, produced by Novartis, was approved by the FDA in February of this year for use in persons 11 through 55 years of age. There is an application pending with FDA to allow use down to age 2 years old, as is the other conjugate vaccine we have, Menectra, produced by Sanofi. Either vaccine may be used for persons 11 through 55 years of age for whom meningococcal conjugate vaccine is recommended. At this time, we'll now move on to our next topic, slide 29. We'll now discuss updated recommendations for the use of the two currently available vaccines for protection against human papillomavirus infection. Human papillomavirus, HPV, is the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States. More than 100 HPV types have been identified. Of these, about 40 types are associated with the development of cervical cancer. Infection with low-risk, non-oncogenic types, such as type 6 and 11, can cause benign or low-grade cervical cell abnormalities or genital warts. High-risk or oncogenic types, such as 16 and 18, can cause low-grade cervical cell abnormalities, high-grade cervical cell abnormalities that are precursors to cancer, as well as anogenital cancers. Type 16 and 18 together account for about 70% of cervical cancer. Next slide, slide 30. We currently have two vaccines for protection against human papillomavirus infection. HPV4 contains HPV type 16, 18, 6, and 11. HPV2 contains HPV type 16 and 18. ACIP recommends vaccination with HPV2 or HPV4 for prevention of cervical cancers and precancers. Both vaccines might provide protection against some other HPV-related cancers in addition to cervical cancer, although there are currently only data sufficient to recommend HPV4 for protection against vulvar and vaginal cancers and precancers. HPV4 is recommended also for prevention of genital warts. Whenever feasible, the same HPV vaccine should be used for the entire vaccination series. No studies address interchangeability of HPV vaccines. However, if the vaccine provider does not know or have available the HPV vaccine product previously administered, either HPV vaccine can be used to complete the series to provide protection against HPV 16 and 18. For protection against HPV 6 or 11 related genital warts, a vaccination series of less than 3 doses of HPV 4 might provide less protection against genital warts than a complete 3-dose HPV 4 series. Next slide, slide 31. ACIP recommends routine vaccination of females ages 11 or 12 years with 3 doses of either HPV 2 or HPV 4. The vaccination series can be started beginning as early as 9 years old. Vaccination is recommended for females ages 13 through 26 years who have not been vaccinated previously or who have not completed a three-dose series. If a female turns 26 years old before the series is complete, the remaining doses can be given after age 26 years. Ideally, vaccines should be administered before potential exposure to HPV through sexual contact. HPV-4 only may be administered to males to reduce their likelihood of acquiring genital warts. This slide is just a reminder that only HPV-4 is licensed for use in males, not HPV-2. The recommendation for use in males is based on prevention of genital warts. Next slide. As far as the future of HPV vaccines, there are pending applications with FDA, which include the extension of the age indications for HPV-4 vaccine for older females, as well as an additional indication in males for prevention of anal cancers, in addition to the current indication for prevention of genital warts. You should now be on slide 34 if you're following along, and now we'll turn our discussion to the use of influenza vaccine. Next slide. In February of this year, history was made with the unanimous vote by ACIP to expand the influenza vaccination recommendations to include everyone 6 months and older to receive an annual influenza vaccination. This includes all adults. It is no longer necessary to inquire about age or risk groups to determine who is eligible for influenza vaccination. Everyone 6 months and older is eligible. Last year, we all dealt with the complexity of having to administer two separate vaccines, the seasonal vaccine and the novel H1N1 vaccine. We're happy this year that the novel H1N1 vaccine has been combined with seasonal components to make only one vaccine for this season, the trivalent vaccine that is noted on this slide, on slide 36. Next slide. With this landmark recommendation to vaccinate everyone, there is still the need to make a special effort to vaccinate persons at increased risk for complications from the flu and their close contacts. This includes persons over 65 years old, persons with chronic illness, such as diabetes and asthma, as well as pregnant women, residents of nursing homes, and healthcare workers. We have received many questions about dosing of children 6 months through 8 years old this season. As in previous seasons, all children ages 6 months through 8 years who receive a seasonal influenza vaccine for the first time should be given two doses. Children who receive only one dose of a seasonal influenza vaccine in the first influenza season that they are vaccinated should receive two doses rather than one in the following influenza season. In addition, for the 2010-11 influenza season, children ages 6 months through 8 years who did not receive at least one dose of an influenza H1N1 monovalent vaccine should receive two doses of the 2010-11 seasonal influenza vaccine, regardless of previous influenza vaccination history. And finally, children ages 6 months through 8 years for whom the seasonal 2009-10 vaccine or influenza monovalent vaccine history cannot be determined, those children should receive two doses of a 2010-2011 seasonal influenza vaccine. In the next few weeks, when the MMWR document containing the ACIP recommendations for flu vaccine are released for the upcoming season, an easy-to-follow flowchart or table will be provided that will make it quick and easy for busy practitioners to determine how many doses the patient will need. Now we're on slide 39, and we'll discuss other recommendations. Next slide, slide 40. Additional updates in the last year have included the recommendation to routinely vaccinate household members and other close personal contacts of adopted children who are newly arriving from countries with high or intermediate hepatitis A endemicity. This updated recommendation was based on increased reports of hepatitis A infection among persons in close contacts with new adoptees from countries of high or intermediate Hep A endemicity. The risk for hepatitis A among close personal contacts of international adoptees is estimated at 106 per 100,000 household contacts of international adoptees within the first 60 days of their arrival in the United States. By comparison, according to surveillance data, the estimated rate of symptomatic hepatitis A in the U.S. general population in 2007 was 1 per 100,000 population. Next slide. You should now be on slide 41. Another recent update involves the use of two specific vaccines. A general rule regarding vaccine administration is that all vaccines can be administered at the same visit as all other vaccines. In December 2009, Merck Pharmaceuticals revised the package insert for herpes zoster vaccine to advise that zoster vaccine and pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine, or PPSV23 vaccine, should not be administered at the same visit. This recommendation was based on a Merck study that showed the average titer against varicella zoster virus was lower in persons who received both of these vaccines at the same visit compared to persons who received these vaccines 4 weeks apart. However, the clinical relevance of this observation is not known because there is no evidence to indicate that antibody titers against varicella zoster virus are a true measure of protection against herpes zoster. Antibody levels to some of the PPSV23 serotypes were also assessed during this study and were not affected by simultaneous administration. The significance of this observation is also not known. Finally, the safety profile of zoster vaccine is not affected by simultaneous administration with PPSV23. Consequently, to avoid introducing barriers to patients and providers who are interested in these two important vaccines, CDC has not changed its recommendation for either vaccine and continues to recommend that zoster and PPSV vaccines be administered at the same visit if the person is eligible for both vaccines. Next slide. We'll now turn our attention to pertussis, a whooping cough, which is highly contagious and one of the most commonly occurring vaccine-preventable diseases in the United States. As you know, people with pertussis usually spread the disease by coughing or sneezing while in close contact with others, who then breathe in the pertussis bacteria. Many infants who get pertussis are infected by older siblings, parents, or other caregivers who might not even know they have the disease. Pertussis, once it's caught, is most severe for babies. Pertussis symptoms in toddlers and older children and adults may be mild at first and mimic a typical upper respiratory infection. It is often not suspected or diagnosed until a persistent cough with spasms sets in after 1 to 2 weeks. In infants, the cough may be mild or absent. Infants may actually present with apnea. There have been recent news articles regarding increased pertussis activity or outbreaks in several states. In particular, California has reported over 1,300 cases and 5 infant deaths due to pertussis. Approximately 700 additional cases are also under investigation. In June of this year, California declared a pertussis epidemic. In response to the epidemic in California, efforts are underway to increase awareness of pertussis and get more people vaccinated. Among other efforts, California hopes to prevent pertussis transmission to the most vulnerable population, that is, infants less than 1 year of age. It's important to know that while a number of states are reporting an increase in the number of pertussis cases in 2010, other states are reporting less pertussis activity in comparison to this time last year. All providers should make sure that their patients as well as themselves are up to date with recommended pertussis vaccines, DTaP for infants and children, and Tdap for adolescents and adults. Further information may also be found on the CDC pertussis page at the URL shown on the slide, slide 42. Next, I would like to turn your attention to how, as providers, we can help increase vaccine coverage rates. Next slide, slide 44. The findings from a 1990s task force on community preventive services still holds true today with regards to what it takes to increase vaccination levels. We have newer challenges now, including an increase in the number of new vaccines and new vaccine combinations, increases in the cost of purchasing vaccines, coupled with a lack of adequate payment to practitioners to buy and administer vaccine, and finally, increased anti-vaccine sentiments from the public. So much remains to be accomplished. As practicing providers, some practical ways we can address this issue are by enhancing access to care. This could include, for example, extending office hours by providing shot-only visits or vaccine-only visits, and looking at other suitable venues for vaccination within the community. Secondly, increasing demand from the public through increasing their awareness of available vaccines. And finally, by addressing provider barriers with the help of physician organizations. Next slide. Some practical tips in a provider setting include, of course, increasing awareness amongst not only the provider but also their staff and the patients of the recommended vaccines at a particular visit, sending out patient reminders or recalls, avoiding missed opportunities to vaccinate through the use of standing orders as an example, and using true contraindications only as a reason to defer vaccination. For example, not deferring vaccines only because of a minor illness. Also, the use of available